It's Paul on Stuff here with Brian Barnhart. I guess a good place to start, Brian, is we were hoping to get some more information from you on the twin sprints idea that's been launched for Texas. Have any decisions been made so far? Or is there anything that's being talked about as bounced around as ideas of how that event is going to run from a regulation rules standpoint?
Well, obviously from an idea standpoint, anytime you've got Eddie Gossage involved, there's lots of ideas.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
And they're all across the board and all over the place. We really think it's going to be an exciting evening with the two races. Right now, that you know, announced as the twin 275s, which is about 100, and I think it's 114 laps apiece. We may go back. I want to revisit that distance, and you know, I don't want to make any promises here, but with the concept of the twin events, all we did was take the 550K and divide it in half. I think we need to do a really good job and sit down and look exactly what 114 laps gives us in terms of fuel mileage.
That's great.
In terms of the number of pit stops on that. I don't want to turn it into a fuel mileage race.
Right.
And if you get a yellow here or there, so while it was announced as twin 275s, that may or may not get adjusted. I think after we do some homework and look at fuel mileage, fuel tank size, tire life, and figure out how many pit stops we want, where we want it to play into it.
Yeah.
You know, that's certainly one of them. We've announced it's half points for each event, which the logic behind that is, you know, you are running two races in one night, and if a guy has a situation, gets involved in an accident, and we just want to go do an x-ray for an ankle or something, and he flies out or drives to a hospital and misses the second race, that's a double penalty.
Right.
So that's why we're doing half points.
That's,
you know, which I think was logical from that standpoint of it. You know, there's a lot of details to be worked out in terms of exactly how long the intermission will be between events. You know, currently we don't sit with the spare cars having any engines in them. That puts a heck of a burden on Honda if they had to have engines and spare cars. So we need to give teams chance to respond to a mechanical or a failure, get the spare car out, get an engine in it, and be prepared to start the second race, because we obviously want the fans to see as good a second event as possible.
Yes.
So we got to look at how long the intermission will be between the two events, what the format will be for starting the second event. Had an interesting concept that we thought about the other day, which, again, no promises here, just throwing some of the ideas out that you were asking about. One of them was starting the second race in order the fastest lap posted during the first race. And we've done some data looking at that, and I went back to the last three races there in 8, 9, and 10. And I think one of them that Dixon won, he only had like the 23rd fastest lap of the race.
Right.
Elio had like the 9th or 10th fastest lap the year that he won. And so it puts some meaning on the first race as well,
mm-hmm.
and how you run it. And what we've typically seen is the guys that are running up front don't run the fastest laps,
right.
because the guys in the back are getting the draft and getting towed along. So that's one of the ideas and concepts out there. We obviously got to figure out how the starting order will be determined for the second event. One of the concepts, that's just one idea.
Brian, we talked to Eddie Gossage just a few days ago, actually, and the idea of race distance came up. And I had thrown out the idea, you know, had you thought about going to, you know, 175, 200-mile events, and I don't know what that comes to, 350K, short of that, I think. But he had mentioned that from the league standpoint, from IndyCar standpoint, you guys have been a little bit reluctant to lengthen races in general. Is there a resistance on your end to add some length to some of these races?
Only from a cost standpoint. You know, obviously every mile we run, there's a cost per mile associated with running the race car. So if you lengthen the races, we're going to need more sets of tires. We're going to need more engine miles. So you're raising the guys' budgets as participants to do that. And we're not getting paid more money from Texas Motor Speedway to run two races down there. You know, if we were getting additional funding as part of our sanctioning agreement to help pay and offset the additional cost of the teams, you know, certainly we don't have any hesitation to it at all. You do have to take television windows into effect on how long the events are and that type of deal. There's always a number of factors of it, but that's the biggest thing we look at is every mile we run costs X amount of dollars, and it's most directly related to engine life, engine miles, rebuild cycles, and number of sets of tires required for the weekend. So if we increased it enough where you needed another couple of sets of tires, well, you've added, you know, $5,000 to each team's budget. Well, $5,000 times 24 cars or 25 cars, we've added $100,000 to the cost of our series to participate and add that. And, you know, we're not getting anything to help defray those $100,000 costs to them. So we really do try and be open-minded of it, but you got to look at it from all aspects. There's always unintended consequences. It costs money to operate the cars. The longer the events, the more it costs our teams.
So you wouldn't say then that there's any resistance as coming from the perspective of keeping the 500 as a separate prestigious event. It's really more of a cost standpoint.
Oh, absolutely.
So we wouldn't be looking then. Has there been any discussion in the background of introducing a couple of other longer events? Because I know that we're saying that Randy Bernard has been saying that he wants to have more sort of big feature events, and that would certainly be something that would qualify as one of those, but that's not able to be considered at this point as one of those features.
I think that's a good idea to have big feature events and longer events. It's just got to be all part of the business mix of what we're doing. And if we get enough money that we can then, you know, that's all our sanction fee is that's the promoter basically paying us to pay our purse to the participants. So if we can get enough money to pay for their expenses to conduct the event, like I said, you know, it's not the only factor, but it's certainly one we're open to. And, you know, like I said, television windows play into it as well, and, you know, that kind of stuff. But cost is always the biggest thing you're primarily focused on.
Sure. Anything else on that topic you want to cover?
I think that covers Texas.
Okay. One other thing that we were hoping to address with you, if you don't mind rewinding with us a little bit, the incidents in Edmonton. There were two actually things that happened that weekend that both raised some questions. Obviously, you've been very clear on the stance of the rule, and I don't think there's anything more to be discussed on that aspect, but there hasn't been a lot of discussion about the term probation and exactly what it means and the ways that it was applied in Edmonton that weekend. Obviously, we have two very different...
Something happened in Edmonton, took the focus off of that, wasn't it?
I don't know what that was. So we've got two very different drivers and two very different probationary situations. Has it been defined exactly what the terms of the probation would be for either of those situations?
Well,
they're
clearly two very different reasons for the probation. Elio's probation is for his off-track behavior.
Yes.
And Milka's probation was for her non-performance on track.
Right.
So, same term used to explain the situation they're both in, but for clearly different reasons.
Yes.
Don't anticipate anything coming out of Elio's situation. That's the logical thing to put him in, you know, after what happened when he got out of the car on that and his actions with two officials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think from Elio's standpoint, I hope people keep in mind the leniency with which we actually dealt with his post-race behavior. There's not another sporting series or sanctioning body in the world that I know of that lets you participate in the following event after you lay your hands on an umpire, a referee, or an official.
That's a good point.
When you touch a Major League Baseball umpire, you're out of the next five games or whatever it is. And again, I think people sometimes lose perspective, and I think we were very understanding of Elio's passion and his emotions that he was going through at that point in time.
Yes.
Understanding that doesn't give you a position or a right to ever lay your hands on an official. And to do it twice is doubly bad, and you know. So probation was very lenient in the long run for what he's doing, because, like I said, in a lot of other sporting events, you're going to be suspended and miss events. And he was able to participate the following event at Mid-Ohio, and we took a lot of that into consideration from a standpoint of, you know, we have people that plan our events. It's not like a baseball game where you play 162 games a year. we run 17 races and people plan, and there were people who had already made travel plans to come to Mid-Ohio that were coming to see him. We didn't feel it was right to cheat the fans out of an opportunity to see him for what he had done, but we also got to make it clear to him what he had done after he got out of the car was completely unacceptable.
Sure.
So the fine is a very healthy fine, and the probation is telling you you can't behave like that.
Sure.
From Milka's standpoint...
Sorry, before we move on to Milka, I think I know the answer to this, but I want to give you the opportunity to vocalize it, because there have been some accusations that are really quite baseless, that... A driver with a less public profile might have been given a different treatment in such a situation and not given that consideration, that there may have been people going to the next event and that's why the LEO was permitted to go on. Do you think there's any base to that?
No, there's not at all. Like you say, it's baseless. It's a matter of, we're trying to attract people to our sport. We're trying to grow this sport, and it wouldn't matter if it was him or any of the other 24 drivers that were in the event. We got to send the message, your behavior is unacceptable. That's why the fine is as steep as it is. That's why the probation's there. But, you know, I think it was also important for us to make sure people get a chance to see the stars of our series.
Sure. Now, in Elliot's case, just again, before we go on to Milka, we know that we're really not expecting any sort of violation of such probation to be coming. But in a theoretical situation, what would be the consequences if it were to happen again?
It'd be hard to speculate on.
Yeah.
You know, it's so hypothetical, it's probably not even worth trying to speculate on.
Okay. So let's move on then to Milka and doing the same comparison of what probation means in her.
Well, her situation really stemmed from a case, and clearly she has struggled at various times. I may not get all this right. I think she's been with us 4 years. Is that right? And she's had her struggles at various times in various racetracks. She's, you know, going back and remember, she started running ovals only when she came with Samax Racing. And the performance parameters, due to the diversity of our schedule, are very difficult to set. Historically, European road racing, followed by when Champ Car was predominantly a road racing types of series, they had the 107% rule in effect. And we have continued to do that as well, but 107% really isn't applicable at events like we're at right now.
Right.
You know, you do 107% lap time here and you'd be accepting somebody running, you know, way off the pace. So, you know, we've got everybody within about 4/10 or 5/10 of a second here on a lap time, whereas where did we just come from?
Infineon
107% was almost 5 seconds a lap. So the difference in that performance parameter from roads and streets versus ovals is significant. And we'd always done it with more miles per hour on the ovals than on the road courses. Road courses, it's more on lap time.
Right.
We've always had performance parameters in place. We've specifically been looking for generally 8 to 10 mile an hour with the leader from a closing rate safety aspect on the ovals. And she struggled in a few, you know, at times doing those. As her career has evolved and she's made the commitment now to run more races this year than she ever had, I think this is her first full season with us. She's going to tracks that she's never been to before. Our series has become more competitive than it's ever been before. You know, there's not a lot of test time. You never get to test at places like Toronto and Long Beach and these temporary facilities. And her struggles have been certainly more easily seen at those types of venues. Based on the schedule and the way it laid out, you know, she really struggled at Long Beach. We didn't let her qualify there, didn't run within 107% in the race, so we parked her pretty early. Then we come off of Long Beach and go to Kansas. Well, she's right back again within the performance parameters and doesn't have a problem. She's within the performance parameters at Indy and at Texas and at Iowa and doing very well. And then we reached a stretch in the schedule. This is a very long-winded way of answering the question,
great.
I guess.
Thank
but
you.
We reached a stretch in the schedule with Toronto and Edmonton, again, places she's never been and places you can't test, where she struggled. And we got to a point where every session at Toronto, both practice sessions on Friday, the Saturday morning practice session, didn't let her qualify because she had not been within 107% in those three sessions, so she doesn't qualify. The Sunday morning warm-up, and then the race, she runs all five of those sessions without reaching the 107%. You know, similar to Long Beach. Well, unlike Long Beach, where she comes out of Long Beach and then has an event where she does meet those parameters, we go to Edmonton, and she starts that same cycle again. Both sessions on Friday. In fact, then it starts kind of compounding itself and getting worse. She started causing full course cautions. She caused one or two of them at Toronto. She did one in the first session at Edmonton. She's not within the 107% in the Friday session, in the second Friday session. And now it's snowballing and getting worse. And it gets worse by the fact that, you know, not just from a safety aspect, from a performance standpoint, but when you start taking track time away from the other competitors because you're causing full course cautions, it just keeps getting worse. So we got to a point where we had done 8 or 9 consecutive sessions or segments of on track, and she had been not allowed to qualify at 2 consecutive events because she hadn't met those parameters, and she had been causing yellows, full course cautions. You got to do something at that point in time. So the probation comes out and it's simply stating, you know, we can't have you causing full course cautions. You need to be with 107%. The probation is, and the expectation is that you're going to do so, or you're in jeopardy of losing your license. You know, it got to a point where she needed to get within the range of expectations of performances. And to her credit, she then went and tested Mid-Ohio, and she ran every session at Mid-Ohio within the 107%, didn't cause any full course cautions there, went to Infineon, you know, she got to test both places, which certainly helps. And again, every session was within the 107%.
Now, this is a great place to ask this question. She ran within the 107% at Mid-Ohio, but she still wasn't permitted to qualify.
No, she was. They chose not to qualify.
Oh, they chose not to qualify.
They chose
not
to.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
They chose not to.
Okay. And did she qualify at Infineon? I'm sorry, I can't recall.
Yes, she did.
Yes, she did.
Yes,
okay.
She did. Yeah.
Great. So that answers that question then. Sorry to interrupt.
So, you know, she has improved her game on the following two road courses that came off of the temporary street circuits at Toronto and Edmonton.
Right.
And she got where she needed to be. That being said, the expectation was also made clear to her in being consistent with our rules enforcement for 2010. We're going to stay at 107%. That's what we started the year with, our parameter participation. But we also made it clear in the letter of probation to her that the performance parameters will tighten even further for next year. You know, we started the year at 107. It's only fair to stay at 107. I don't want to change the goalpost on her mid-season.
Sure.
But she's been told that the expectation will be for her to be a lot closer than that for 2011 if she expects to receive a license in 2011 as well. Because, you know, we've got to continue to address, as Randy has said, we want the best drivers in the world here, and we want people to be. And I mean, when you've got a whole field within a certain level, and then one driver is still within 107, but is still so far away from everybody else, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see us talk this winter, and before we come into it, that 107 could go to 104 or 105.
Right.
And it's a pretty significant leap.
So has there been any discussion then of how long the probation will last in terms of how long you're monitoring her for such things?
I thought we did it for the rest of the year, didn't we?
Okay, so 2011 is a clean slate for her then?
Yeah, we generally start with clean slates for everybody. Unless somebody does something at the Homestead event, we can carry it over to the following year. But her probation was through the remainder of the season, just as Elio's is, that type of deal. I thought we did them both the way through.
Okay. So going into next year then, were she not to stand up to those performance parameters, how much tolerance would we be looking at of...
Not much.
No. Okay. Because, I mean, you outlined very well that the Toronto and Edmonton was starting to have a lot of effect and then triggered the probation. Had she continued to show poor performance, would you have pulled her off track before
absolutely.
The end of the year?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. That was the whole purpose of the probation in the first place, and the expectation her performance has got to improve.
And that would have been a permanent removal of license?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brian, let's switch gears a little bit here. From a competition standpoint, obviously the big story, at least in the second half of the season, has been some of the blocking issues. Obviously, in the fallout of Edmonton, came to the fore. You said at that time that this rule, you know, the dividing the rule, the track and half rule, is in effect on the road and street courses and some of the ovals. Mm-hmm. You were kind of vague about what you meant by some of the ovals. First of all, I guess, could you clarify that? And secondly, what are we going to be looking for at the rest of the ovals tonight at Chicago, next week at Kentucky? What are you going to be looking for in enforcement of blocking rules here? Especially since we've seen this track can be three, four cars wide.
Well, and that's the thing. Anyone running an abnormal racing line on road and street circuits, it's so easy, especially when you run the knockout qualifying that we do. As an example with Elio, you know, and asking him afterwards, when he and I talked on the Monday after the event, and, you know, I said, Elio, did you run that line during qualifying? Well, no. Why not? Because that's not the fastest line around the racetrack. So at events like that, it is very easy to identify what the normal race line is. The same couldn't be said for a place like this. Here at Chicago, here, what is the fastest line around this racetrack? Well, our cars are capable, just like you're watching right now, of hugging the white line and running the bottom. So you can't take the inside half away from here. That is the fastest line of the racetrack. So the guy in front, if he chooses to run the bottom at a place like Chicagoland, he can run the bottom. I can't say leave the inside half lane open, because it is the fastest lane, and if you're in front, you should have first choice where to put your car. And if you are in front, you would always choose the optimum lane for the fastest lap possible, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then why didn't he? Because he was choosing to block. You know, if you're in front and you have no one to pass, you want to run the fastest lap possible to lessen the chances of getting passed.
Right.
He didn't run that line. Why? Because he was choosing to defend or block rather than run his fastest lap and hope it was fast enough. And, you know, balancing all that stuff out, safety is always part of it, and I know people may not want to listen to that, but, you know, all it takes is one example, you know, and within a week of when Edmonton happened, and I don't remember what it was like a world challenge start, and that guy blocked that guy. Did you guys ever see this? And the guy flew up and hit the bridge.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Okay? You got that, you got Jeff Krosnov, you got Kenny Brackett, Texas. That's just off the top of my head, guys. It's a safety situation for open wheel race cars. If we need to adjust or change, like I said, we're open minded to it. But I can tell you, 90% of our drivers in our paddock want us to race the way we're racing right now, because it's their butts on the line. And they don't want to be the guy flying into the bridge because the guy in front of them blocked them. And when you throw the effect on that on top of that, I've said all along, guys, if we want to change that rule, the person whose quality of life is going to improve the most is me. You know, my driver's meetings will get a lot shorter. I'll just stand up and tell them, 200 laps, guys, first one back wins. I'll count laps. You know, it can be that simple. But it's not that simple. So we got those reasons in play, but then you take it even further than that. The owners in our paddock don't want it, because all of a sudden, if you start letting guys nerf people out of the way, because that's what's going to happen. If you let him run that line, and that's the line he's going to run, well, then you're going to have to allow the guy behind him to take action. Because if that's the only way you can pass is in the inside half, which is what you do on road courses, then that guy's not going to have the opportunity to pass. What's he going to do to him? He's going to turn him around. So all of our paddock is going to start buying a bunch of noses and front wings, because you're going to start using them. And then you're going to buy a bunch of rear wings, because when you turn the guy around, he's going to back it in the tire barrier. And then we're going to have an event that is full of cautions, because every time we have a restart, we're going to go yellow again, because down in turn one of St. Pete or Toronto or Long Beach or wherever, we turned the leader around and we're now full course caution again. You'll have no flow to the event. The fans won't watch any passing. Is that what we want to do? I don't know. Again, I'm open to it, folks, but there's a reason why we are what we are. And most everybody, like I said, adheres to those rules.
Yeah.
there was an example. Unfortunately, I didn't want to do that, but I didn't create that situation. He did. I have to respond to the situations they create. And I don't want to be the determining outcome of the race, but then again, I got to do the job I was hired to do as well. And, you know, everybody else plays by the rules, and when they don't, the expectation is for me to do the job that I'm supposed to do. And we did.
Well, Brian, I want to give you the chance to address something that a lot of the fans have said and some of the media have said, and that's in some of the consistency and some of the blocking calls. At Indianapolis, we saw a very, very short leash on blocks. I know Graham Rahal was very vocal about his, that he didn't feel he was blocking when he got penalized. And then we went to Texas.
Actually, I disagree with that. Graham sent me a text that admitted he did it, but he said other people were doing it too. So he didn't deny that he did.
Okay.
In fact, at the banquet Monday night, he said, "I'm sorry about that. I was all over the place yesterday."
Right.
So Graham admitted. They all know what they do.
But then we turned around at Texas the next week, and there's the very infamous, I guess, the situation with Danica and Tony, where there was what appeared to be a very blatant block that was not reprimanded, at least in a penalty sort. And that there's a lot of fans that are concerned that that blocking isn't being consistent from race to race, within a race, from driver to driver.
Mm-hmm.
Do you care to address those concerns?
Well, absolutely, because they don't know what... Danica got a warning for what she did at Texas to Canuck. And all three drivers that were black flagged at Indianapolis, John Andretti, Graham, everybody else got one too. All three of them were warned before they got blocking penalties too. So there is consistency. However, depending on the stage of the race, you can't always give someone a guaranteed warning. And consistently in the drivers' meetings, as I have told them 1,000 times, there is no guaranteed warning. That's what this meeting is for, to be warning you not to do it. And at certain stages of the race, you can't let a guy keep one in his back pocket, because if he uses it on the white flag lap, oh, well, he just determined the winner of the race. And he did it in an unsportsmanlike fashion. You can't let them do that. So if the situation allows for us to give a warning, we have traditionally tried to give warnings and pointed out to them and set the deal out. You know, Scott Dixon got black flagged at Indy a few years back. He was warned before he got it. The challenge gets to be, from a driver's standpoint, when we warn them, I'm not talking to the drivers. We're talking to the crew. The crew doesn't always pass it on. Dixon's biggest complaint to me after Indy a few years back was, "Nobody told me you ever warned me." Then I watched the tape of the broadcast, and they even said you had warned me. Well, that's between you and your team.
Yeah.
You know? He says, "If I'd have known you were watching me and had warned me, I wouldn't have done it the second." Well, then tell your guy to tell you when you get warned. But all three guys that got penalties at Indy were warned before they got them. Danica was warned at the stage of race at Texas, and she never did it again, so she didn't get another penalty. You know? And, you know, when you're coming down to the situation where you had it, at Edmonton, you don't have... It isn't right when you're now determining the outcome of the race and allowing someone to win the race, and in doing so, they did it by disadvantaging their competition in an unsportsmanlike fashion. So there are certain times that warnings are capable of being used and other times that they're not.
Do you have a general rule of thumb, first half of the race, outside the last 25, 50 laps, something?
It's more discretionary than anything else. And some of it's the severity of what they did, you know. I mean, again, the nature of what they're doing at a place like Texas, which is like here, you want the bottom, and that's the fastest place, and if you're in front, you can choose to do that. Now, Indianapolis this year was the first year we ever tried to divide the track in a similar fashion that we've done the road courses. And it's because the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen the racing line keep moving lower and lower down the front straightaway and back straightaway at Indy. So specifically for the 2010 Indy 500, we told them, "Guys, when you exit off 2 and 4, I don't want you coming down more than half track. I've got to leave the inside lane open, or again, we're not going to have any passing for the fans. The cars are so equal. You have such a small difference in performance from one car to the next that guys were running so low down the front and back straightaways at Indy and wait until the last minute to move back out to turn in. Well, then you don't give anybody room to get underneath you and pass you." So we were losing the essence of what our sport is about, and that's overtaking. You've got to try and create a scenario, what we're looking at, to try and allow for passing. And we did that at Indy this year and said, guys, you've got to leave the inside half of the racetrack open. And again, that's because you can't run around the white line at Indy.
Right.
You've got to get back out and turn in and apex and then exit high and do that kind of stuff. Well, they had learned that they can do so, and at the last minute swing back out, and it just doesn't leave enough room. So the greatest asset you have in Indianapolis is 5/8 mile straightaways. Well, they were taking those away by running so low that we were leaving them with about 300 foot of straightaways, and that's not enough room to pass somebody. So we specifically said at Indy this year, guys, we really want you no lower than mid track, and we're going to leave the inside half of the track for passing. And some people understood that that was a continuation, and we made it clear in the driver's meeting we're officiating Indianapolis in a similar fashion to we do at road and street courses by dividing the track like that. You can't do that at places like here in Texas because guys are going to run the bottom. What we're going to look for here is moving your car in response to the actions of a following car. Now, if you're both on the bottom down here and this guy swings up and you move up, not going to want to see that. Or if you what we watch a lot for places like this will be the closing rate. And you'll see somebody from race control, you'll see somebody get a run on somebody coming out of two, and the distance between them is getting smaller. You see right away the 17's got a run on the 15. And all of a sudden, if the 15 then moves because you got to run, that's what you're looking. If you're impeding the progress of a car behind you by switching lanes or by moving your car in response to the lane that the car behind you is choosing, again, I go back to what I said earlier. If you're the car in front, you've got first choice of where to put your car on the racetrack. And if you're in the car in the front, there is never a reason for you to choose anything other than the fastest line possible for you to run. If you choose another line because of the actions of a following car or a car that's got a run on you, you're defending or blocking. And again, our reasons for it are safety more than anything else. It makes my life and Al Jr.'s life and Tony Kottman and Bill Vanisander by race control, it makes our job very difficult. And it'll be incredibly difficult here tonight because we've got 29 cars. And that's, again, I think something people lose perspective on is the ratio of officials to competitors in our sport compared to, you know, basketball, there's 10 players and 3 referees. There's 1 for 3. We don't have that here. You know, we got really 2 pairs of eyes watching the track. The other guys are watching some video replays, but we got basically 2 guys watching 29. And there's going to be a lot of stuff we miss. You talk about consistency, well, our focus is primarily at the front of the field. There could be somebody block somebody for 15th and 16th, and absolutely, we may miss it. But, you know, we're not like other sports. We don't have timeouts. We don't have, you know, video replay. Our sport's nonstop. When you drop green flag, it's a constant event until the checkered flag falls.
I've got one more question, a safety question, hypothetical. Since the accident in Indianapolis, the bad accident at the end with Mike Conway and Ryan Hunter-Reay, that was caused when Hunter-Reay ran out of fuel and had a very sudden change in velocity. And then I listened to you yesterday during the final practice. You were very vocal about drivers running in a pack and then suddenly dropping out with massive speed changes. Has there been any discussion within IndyCar about somehow indicating if a car is running very low on fuel to avoid a situation like we talked about at Indianapolis?
Yeah, what we've looked at doing is, and that's the thing that makes me nervous. Like in yesterday's practice, you've got a situation that won't exist tonight. No one wants to go to the back tonight. In practice, guys want to go to the back, see if they can work way to the front. So you get people to lift, and that's where it creates unsafe situations out there along the lines of what you're talking about. You know, tonight, no one's going to want to go backwards. So,
but if they run into a fuel issue.
Yeah, I'm just talking, that's why you get nervous in the practice where you're at. In terms of what happened like it did at Indianapolis, one of the things we've looked at doing is utilizing our tail light, which is the rain light, and it's also the caution light for ovals that we're running, that type of deal. We've looked at maybe coming up with something and maybe either outlining it in blue or something that when a car reaches a certain fuel level or is low on fuel, that the tail light comes on that car. At least that way the guy knows the car he's following is low on fuel situation. So we have explored a couple of different ways to try and make that work as well. You know, it gets a little confusing. I'm not trying to be disrespectful of the drivers in any way, shape, or form, but sometimes you can overwhelm them with too much information. you know, what's that light on that car mean, and what's this one on for, and all that kind of stuff. But we're talking with the drivers as well and get their ideas on it. You know, they get a pretty good idea when you're at the end of the race like you were in Indy. You had a lot of people that were stretching on fuel, so that thought process is always going to be in the back of your mind. But on the other hand, they're so focused on just passing the car in front of them. And I think that's what happened with Mike in that situation.
I do have one more question, and I feel terrible that this is going to be the last one, because it's not a very positive way to end off, unfortunately. But something you mentioned earlier made me think of it. We're hearing rumblings that the drivers are talking about creating a union of sorts, or an organization where they will have a representative who can portray their feelings on the way that things are being conducted. And there was, unfortunately, a quote from one of the drivers saying that they don't feel that the league, from a regulation standpoint, is hearing their concerns on some issues, and that's the root of that. How has the series responded to that?
I think it's an incredibly positive thing. I'm so happy that they're doing this. It is the best thing from a league standpoint, from a competitor standpoint, that we could find our situation in. I think it is the best scenario. We can now have them come to us through elected representatives. Unofficially, I've kind of always done it through Dario, who has an uncanny ability to separate his personal agenda from work. He really looks at big picture stuff better than any driver I've ever been around, especially that's currently in our series. So I've always utilized Dario as a sounding board. And I mean, when he comes to me, he's not coming for something that's a benefit for him. He's really a big picture thinker, like I said. Whether it's Dario or TK or Justin, and they come to us, it'll be so nice to know that when the elected representative comes to us, that they are speaking on behalf of the majority, or they wouldn't get to us. You know, and that's where it's been a bit of a challenge. We've always got open doors and let them all come in, but if one guy comes in, why are you really telling me this? Is this because it's something to benefit you, and that's where we got to separate? Is there an agenda here, or is this better for everybody truly? Now, for them to even get to us, it will have been voted upon by the group, and it will be the majority. So, like I say, I don't view this development as anything short of positive. It's a wonderful development. So, because it's not just competition, it's not safety, it's PR, it's admin, it's, you know, racetracks. We get a situation where it's so much stronger and easier for us now. And if I get Dario to come to us and say that the warm-up lane at Texas is too rough and we need it, you know, the pit exit lane has a big bump right over the tunnel coming between 1 and 2 and it's got to be addressed, then it strengthens my position to be able to go back to Eddie Gossage in Texas and say, our driver representative from the whether you call them a union or not, has voiced a concern that on behalf of all of our drivers, or at least the majority of our drivers, they think this is an unsafe situation and it has to be addressed. That gives me more leverage to go back to promoters and get things the way they need to be done. So whether it's facility related, competition related, car related, you know, PR schedules, autograph sessions, marketing platforms, there's nothing but good can come out of it from my point of view.
Great. Well, that ended up being a great place to end off. If you have anything to add.
I think we've taken up more time than we
more than we were really scheduled for. Thanks so much, Brian,
my
for
pleasure,
your time.
Guys.
Really
I appreciate it.
And